Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Stick Together, Australia's only national radio show all about workers' rights, social justice and union news. Stick Together is produced at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne and broadcast across the country on the Community Radio Network. I'm Diana Beaumont. And remember, live radio isn't the only way to listen to Stick Together anymore. You can subscribe to a Stick Together podcast at 3CR's website, which is 3cr.org.au, or like our page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. On today's show, we've got two very different stories for you. We'll begin the program in India and discuss how the newly elected government plans to water down labour laws and privatise more than $11 billion worth of state assets. Then, later in the program, I'll be joined by Christy Kane, Secretary of the Maritime Union of Australia's branch in Western Australia. His union is challenging the federal government in the federal court after legislation was introduced to Parliament that would make it easier to employ foreign workers on low wages and conditions on Australia's offshore oil and gas rigs. I'll talk to Christy about the case, but also about a public spat between the MUA in Western Australia and Martin Ferguson, the former resources minister in the Labor cabinet. Christy Kane moved to have Ferguson expelled from the ALP recently after Ferguson called the MUA a job-killing and rogue union. We'll hear Christy's response later in the program today. But for our first story this week, halfway across the world, let's hear a Labor activist's analysis of what Narendra Modi and the BJP's election victory will mean for workers in India. The BJP is the first party to win a single-party majority in India's national government in 30 years, and Prime Minister Modi is promising to use this majority to reform the country's labour laws and accelerate the privatisation of state industries. Today I spoke to Sujata Gothaskar, who's a labour activist with the Forum Against the Oppression of Women, about the Modi government's first 2 months in office. I began by asking Sujata about the political background of the BJP, which is best known for its Hindu nationalist platform.
It is what we would call a right-wing party that believes in Hindutva, which is the political hegemony of Hinduism, Hindutva vis-a-vis all other religions. It has traditionally been a party that is of the middle class and of the trader class, and has been apathetic or antipathetic to workers and to the poor. It's been right-wing in several ways in terms of its politics, its economics, its mass base.
Well, now that Narendra Modi has been elected as the Prime Minister of India, the Reuters news agency likens him to Ronald Reagan or Margaret Thatcher and sees that he's going to be bringing massive neoliberal reforms to India. Why do you think the media makes that comparison with Modi and Thatcher and Reagan?
One thing I think common to them is they think regulation of labour or repression of labour is a part of their politics, that the government should govern as little as possible, especially where corporates are concerned, where enterprises are concerned, to give a free run to corporates. In the period of Reagan and Thatcher, the corporates had relatively less power than they have now all over the world. I think it's even more dangerous what the present version represents.
One of the main objectives of the new BJP government in India is to reform the labour laws. How are they proposing to change the labour laws?
I think the main objective of the BJP government is to give a free run to capital and hence to rein in labour in every possible way. I think what they've done, they have targeted five acts, the Industrial Disputes Act, the Factories Act, the Contract Labour Act, the Apprenticeship Act and the Boilers Act. But at the one state level, where there is a BJP government and where there is much less industry, that is Rajasthan, they have tried to take the initiative and go much further. Less and less rights to workers. In fact, in some ways, they're going much, they're really backward.
But are the labour laws even enforced in India? We hear that India is characterised by a remarkably high number of small companies, which is a way for employers to avoid enforcement of the labour law in the first place.
Yes, you're quite right that enforcement, implementation has been a major problem. And hence, the whole argument that if labour laws are changed, employment will increase, etc., don't hold ground because labour laws have never been implemented. But if a very, very, very small section of workers is organized, it is possible for them to at least push, because the laws are there on statute. Now, if they've removed from the statute, then there is absolutely no possibility for anybody or any or even the most organized workers to fight for their rights.
Well, often in India, when workers do fight for their rights, the struggles are bitter and often the repression from police and the state is very violent.
Yeah, there's been so much of repression and even the basic rights for you workers to choose their own union have been denied. So it's a violation of the constitution, violation of the labour laws in India, as well as of the ILO conventions.
We're speaking to Sujata Gothaskar about the election of the BJP government and new Prime Minister Narendra Modi in India. Sujata, tell us about the new BJP government's plans to privatise state-owned companies in India.
For one thing, it's just a little over 2 months that it's in power. So it's not that they have a whole lot of things that have begun, but they've made a lot of statements. And one of the statements is that they believe in PPP, public-private partnership, and they've even talked about the nationalized banks, getting them into the PPP model.
Yes, and they've said that they intend to privatize at least 700 billion rupees worth of state assets. That's almost 12 billion US dollars. And that's in areas, what, like railways, energy resources, telecommunications, is that right?
Basically the major utilities and services that as well as heavy industry. See, the thing is that for example, the health sector or the education sector, if there is a complete privatization that happens, it is basically the poor that will lose out, that workers who will lose out, both in terms of access as well as in terms of rights. Like, for example, if you look at the postal services, there are a whole lot of areas where if they are privatized, the letters will not go. Or anything will, because there are very, very far off areas where that service is needed, but it is not quote unquote economical. The other thing that has done, which is even more dangerous than privatization, has been to allow to again make statements and to actually act on some of them. Land Acquisition Act, for example, where the corporates have been given complete free run They've also talked about the environmental clearance being hastened, or environmental precautions. So that is a very important.
Yes. Well, the BJP government also announced in its first budget the intention to reduce food and fuel and fertiliser price subsidies. And can you explain how that this will also affect the poor of India?
Yeah. What one can see right now is a very, very severe food inflation. And a part of it is related to fuel prices. Food inflation has been so high that, vegetables, there have been vegetables that have increased in prices by over 100%. Similarly, rice and cereals generally have, their prices have risen. Part of it has to do with fuel increase, whether it's diesel and petrol and so on. But also, the cooking gas is also something that has been that has increased, and there is an attempt to increase it further in this. There's a statement that it will increase further. The food subsidy, there have been several movements which talk about the fact that there is a surplus of food, food grains, and most of them rotting in the Food Corporation of India go-downs. And the whole this thing was to give access to through food subsidies and through the Food Security Act to people. And that's something that they have said that they will do, that they will abide by the Congress, the act, which is actually a very, very weak act. We think that the general thrust of the government is to minimize the role of governance, except where repression is concerned. But governance of government, so that is one of the reasons why there is no checks or in terms of. The other, in terms of price rise, for example, whether it is the fuel, lack of fuel subsidy, or the other thing is also the traditional base of the BJP has been the trader class, and that's another reason why there's so much of possibility, so much of hoarding that takes place, and that, hence, so the food inflation is to do with both the hoarding as well as the fuel lack of fuel subsidy.
That was Sujata Gothaskar, a Labour activist with the Forum Against the Oppression of Women in India, talking to me about the plans of the new BJP government in India to reform labour laws, remove subsidies for the poor, and privatise public assets. Unfortunately, we can see the rhetoric of small government is being used to end wealth redistribution mechanisms and social security programs across the world, even in India, which still has such a massive problem of poverty. No country in the world has reduced poverty by market-based capitalist economics. So in future programs, we'll try and bring you news about how working class organisations in India are fighting to reassert the needs of people over profit.
Stick together.
You're listening to Stick Together on Community Radio.
Asia-Pacific Currents.
News and labour issues from the Asia-Pacific region.
We strongly condemn the police that arrest the protesters.
Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock.
On Community Radio 3CR.
Workers of the world should unite to fight this greedy capitalist.
Brought to you by Australia-Asia Worker Link.
And next up on Stick Together today, I'll play an interview I recorded with a regular guest on this program, Christy Kane, who's Secretary of the Maritime Union of Australia's branch in Western Australia. So I wanted to begin today with a recurring topic for your unions, and that's wages and conditions on offshore oil and gas rigs. When we had you on the show in 2012 and also last year, we talked about disputes with Gorgon and Woodside, who hire foreign nationals on their offshore rigs at lower wages and worse conditions than the Australian minimum standards. And now that issue's arisen again. The MUA in Western Australia is challenging the federal government in the federal court, arguing that the government's acted beyond its powers in trying to pass regulation that would make it easier for companies to employ foreign labour on offshore oil and gas rigs. Can you explain the union's case for us?
Yeah, sure, Diane, and the listeners, and it's always good to speak on 3CR, by the way. But look, in respect to the visa situation, as you know, the Labour Party, just before they came out of office, moved legislation that would require market testing for people to come in here on 457 visas, appropriately if they had the skills. And the skills wasn't here in Australia for Australians to work here in them jobs. Now, what's happened since then is... Mr. Abbott got in, and Michelle Cash and others, and the employers lobbied the Liberal government to change the regulations and legislation, well, change the legislation, throw that out, and move through the Senate another type of visa, which would basically a 966 visa, which would MCV visa, which would give the rights for foreign workers to come here, and not only foreign workers to come here and work, but foreign workers to come here and be exploited by the employers by not paying them an Australian rate of pay.
Your argument is that if these visas are used to bring in workers from overseas, the only reason employers do that is to pay lower wages and to reduce working conditions, and that's what you want to avoid on the rigs. Can you give us some examples of just how low some of these foreign workers' wages have been?
Well, you've seen a test case went to the High Court of Australia in respect to, I think it was a year or two ago, where we had Filipino painters on an oil rig on $3 to $5 an hour. It's absolutely ridiculous. And working in Australian waters on totally inferior wages and conditions. And, you know, the Maritime Union, quite proudly, goes into bat for workers who are being exploited as well on vessels when they come to this country. And on many occasions, we've seen rogue employers not pay them any wages for at least 6 and 12 months, have no wages at all coming in. So, you know, we're not, so to say, some people would say we're racist or whatever it is. What we're saying is, you live in this country, you deserve a job in this country, especially if you're living here, paying taxes in this country, and you should be trained in this country to the best available skills you can get.
And when you say Australian workers, that's not an ethnic statement, is it? That's more a statement about people who are already here in the local community being employed on wages and conditions that are acceptable to our labour movement.
That's correct. And, you know, we've got many of our members are Greek, Italian, Irish, English, whatever they are. If they've come here, they've lived here, they've brought their children up here, they pay taxes here. You know, a multicultural country as Australia is, and we've got no problem. Where we do have the problem is employers exploiting the labour that comes in here and not pay and refuse to pay them Australian rate of pay.
And there's another issue that you're currently disputing with the government, and that is exactly what the migration zone should be in Australian waters. Can you explain that?
Well, what they're saying now is, John Howard was saying it as well, but more Tony Abbott now is saying, let's open the borders up, let's have free trade, a free market, and bring whoever, and the employer should be able to bring in whoever they like on whatever wages and conditions they feel fit they should pay them. And that's what they're actually trying to do. What they've done in the UK and some points in places in Europe, they've done exactly that. They've opened up the borders and it's down to the lowest common denominator. And there's people over there in the UK now on vessels trading around the country on less than £5 an hour.
We're speaking to Christy Kane, who's Secretary of the Maritime Union of Australia in Western Australia. Christy, another issue that we've seen in the news is the MUA's dispute with DP World, the terminal operator at the Fremantle port. We saw that DP World threatened to lock out MUA members if they went ahead with industrial action. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, that's correct. We, on Thursday afternoon...
That's, Thursday, 30th of August?
Yes, yeah, we decided to... The negotiations had broken down. Our members had voted in a secret ballot, John Howard's way, by the way, and they decided to take a four-hour stoppage, in a terminal. And then they all received, 215 wharfies received an email saying that if they took the four-hour stoppage, they'd be locked out indefinitely. Well, we took the four-hour stoppage and the company, seeing the error of its ways, in my view, decided to come back to the negotiating table. We didn't blink.
So this case sort of has significance for industrial relations generally because unions like the MUA have to jump through many legal hoops and expensive legal hoops to get protected status for strike action. But on the other hand, you have the employer threatening lockouts if workers do go ahead with their strike. Do employers have any similar restraints on their ability to lock out workers, just like workers are restrained in their ability to take strike action?
Well, it doesn't look that way, and that's not in the Fair Work Act. I think as well as what we can take the action, they can actually lock you out for an indefinite period of time. The issue for us is basically industrial action is a last resort, and we only proceed to do that when the employer is not bargaining in good faith. And on these occasions, especially in the offshore oil and gas and on the docks, we've been trying to negotiate with rogue employers in the offshore for about 18 months and got nowhere. And in the stevedore side, we've been the last 6 months with turning up to meeting after meeting where they just go, no, 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 no. And it's not about money. It's more about security of employment, friendly family rosters, for the wharfies and for the seafarers. And look, we just want to get on with business. As I say, you know, we're a union that bargains hard, and there are employers out there, ideologues out there, that just want to take us on every time an EBA comes around.
Yeah, well, it seems that you've got disputes right along the WA coast. You've got possible strike action at the Esperance Port, at the Mermaid Marine Facility in Dampier, at the Fremantle facilities. Is this indicative of a very aggressive attitude that employers are taking towards the MUA at the moment in Western Australia?
It looks that way to us. You know, we'd like to sit down and bargain in good faith with these employers, but... obviously, a Liberal government, they believe they can take us on. In Dampier, we were going to have a 10-day stoppage first up, and that was because they took out of the last document over 4 years, they took every clause apart and gave us a document that had hard won conditions that we'd had in, all taken out, and said, this is what you're getting. And so, well, we said, that's what you're getting, you're going to have a 10-day stoppage. And, you know, we make no apologies for that. You know, I haven't seen a poor offshore oil and gas company, and especially the likes of Chevron, which is anti-union, anti-worker around the joint, come over here in Australia, take all the resources out of the place and want to build this joint on the back of Australian labour, but not pay them the right wages and conditions. And it's been boom times over here, and I think our members and others, unions members, they should get a little bit part of that boom.
You're listening to Stick Together on the Community Radio Network, and we're speaking to Christy Kane, Secretary of the Maritime Union of Australia in Western Australia. Christy, I wanted to finish the interview on a sort of political note. Martin Ferguson, the former Minister for Resources, is now on the advisory board for the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, and he in recent months has come out with fierce criticism of your branch of the MUA, calling you, quote, a job-killing and rogue union. And in response, the West Australian branch of the Labor Party attempted to have him ejected. Can you talk a bit about this sort of public spat with Martin Ferguson and his criticisms of your union?
Yeah, well, Martin knows that we never looked for a dispute with him. He came over to West Australia. He's now, as you say, on the board of ATL, but he's also with the multinational, one of the biggest in the world, British Gas. So Martin actually is where he should be with the employers and stop charading around as if he's a Labour man. We moved quite clearly, and I got up and moved that motion at the ALP. And I've got to say, it was supported 100% that Martin Ferguson should be expelled from the ALP. We got no apologies to make to him and all his rants on behalf of the employers and AMA. I do believe that through the Trades and Labour Council in Victoria, they moved unanimously to have him expelled as well. And I've got to say the same up in Queensland. Now, you know, we must be saying something right here. Martin is now working for the employers. Martin is now getting paid by the employers. So Martin will always rant off about unions that are having a go. It's not only my union, it's any union that Martin has come across in negotiations. In fact, I don't believe I've ever spoken to Martin Ferguson, but he's run off saying my union and this branch is a rogue union. And as far as we're concerned, we bargain hard and we bargain in good faith. And I think Martin should keep his nose out of our business.
So do you think he will be expelled from the ALP?
I don't know. You get up to Sydney, I suppose. There's a lot of right-wing people up there that might like the way Martin does his business. And he was head of the ACTU and he was, you know, in the cabinet in the ALP, I suppose. A few people owe him a few favours. But that's why we're taking a keen interest in the ALP over here. And we should be all around the country because people like Ferguson should be removed from the ALP and go with his mate, like Tony Abbott and Abet. And he's in the right camp as far as we're concerned, so there's no apologies to Martin. Martin's made his own bed, he can lie in it.
Well, let's leave it on that note. Christy Kane, Secretary of the MUA in Western Australia, thanks for joining us so much on Stick Together today.
Yeah, thanks, and thanks to all the listeners over there. They've got a lot of good friends over there. Thanks a lot, Di.
And that's all we have time for on Stick Together this week. And like Christy Kane, we'd love to keep in touch with our friends in the union movement across the country. So if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can send an email to sticktogether3cr@gmail.com or you can call 3CR, where we're based in Melbourne, on 03 9419 8377. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation, another great friend, for its ongoing financial support of the program. I'm Diana Beaumont. Thanks for listening, and do tune in again at the same time next week.